Good evening. My name's Damien Wild and I'm editor of EG. And I was going to say welcome to another EG question time, but it doesn't feel like just another EG question time. It feels like a big one. We've got an expectant panel and I'm sure you're all armed with questions. So much has happened since our last Manchester QT 12 months ago in this very room. In fact, so much has happened since our last big event, our development summit in Manchester, which was only a few short months ago. And so much tends to happen when we do come as well. When we were here last September, we were in this very room, and just hours earlier, Sir Howard had announced his resignation. In May, we were at the Principal on Oxford Street, just around the corner, on the day a supremely confident Conservative Party revealed its snap general election manifesto. And that didn't go so well for them, did it? Today has been comparatively quiet, I think, at least in terms of issues that directly affect affect property in this part of the world. But given all of those issues that are currently live, from housing to infrastructure spending to Brexit and events in Florence tomorrow, it will certainly change over the course of the weeks and months ahead. Maybe it'll change over the course of the next hour. We'll see. Now, I know many of you, most of you, all of you will be familiar with the question time format. Raise your hand to ask a question. I'll come to as many of you as possible. Say who you are and a microphone will come and find you. And disagree with our panel, as well as asking questions, feel free to do that. And if you're tweeting about the event this evening, do use the hashtag EGQT as well. And we also have the Slido app, which I think some of you who've been to our events before will have used. Just go to Slido on your phones to submit questions, and those details are up on the screens now, and use that same hashtag to make sure we're able to see them. And you can like questions at the top as well to make sure the questions you want answered do get asked. Some of you have pre-submitted questions as well, and I'll put those to our panel as well, as many as I can. So to our panel, closest to me is Andy Burnham, of course, the first Mayor of Greater Manchester, elected in May. Next to him is Tom Gilman, Managing Director of Kier Property North, where he has a particular specialism in development funding. Then we have Jeremy Hines, Head of Planning for the North at Savills, and also National Head of the Retail Planning Team. Then we have Darren Hughes, a partner in the real estate team at Gateley PLC, the UK's first listed law firm. Sheila McNerney is Head of Development at Salford City Council, where it falls to her to deliver development, investment and regeneration across the city and maximise the benefits of growth. And last but not least at the end is Kieran Quinn, who's been leader of Tameside Council since 2010, and he's also chair of the Greater Manchester Pension Fund Management Panel, the largest local government pension scheme fund in the UK, with assets of just under £20 billion, which is a figure remarkably similar to the figure that's being discussed tomorrow, I think. But just a coincidence there, I'm sure. Right, let's get down to questions. Can I start with Neil Wood of CLS Risk Solutions? Neil. The microphone's just behind you, Neil.
Evening, everybody. Can I just ask, what are the timescales in implementing Andy Burnham's key objectives, please?
I'll ask Andy that, I think. Key objectives and what are all the timescales?
Well, of course, they're all on different timescales. So let me give you an idea of some of the the headline commitments. I made a commitment in the campaign, a very personal commitment around rough sleeping and homelessness. On rough sleeping, I've said that I want to end it by 2020. It's a very challenging goal, but it's a crisis situation, as you can see if you walk out and see what's happening. So that's tough, but that's the commitment I've made there. I've said I want to do more to support young people in Greater Manchester with the costs of travel. So I've already introduced a half-price bus ticket. We're going to go further on Metrolink soon, but we're working towards a free bus pass. That will only be possible, this is for 16 to 18-year-olds, that will only be possible when we are able to use powers that are in the bus services bill. So if I'm honest about that one, it's looking like that will be 3-4 years before we can implement that. There are a whole range of other things that I could point to on different timescales, but, you know, I'm focused on making change as quickly as I possibly can. I left Westminster to do that. I'm sick of the old world of point scoring. I'm here to make a difference, and I want to make a difference as quickly as I possibly can. And, you know, I could give you more detail without I wanted to speak for ages, but, you know, I want to see change as quickly as possible. One last area, cycling. You know, we've already seen the arrival of Mobike. I wouldn't say that was all down to me, but actually I facilitated it in my early days. I've appointed Chris Boardman as our cycling and walking commissioner. I want to see improvements to the cycling infrastructure in Greater Manchester before I stand again for election in a couple of years, or 2.5 years' time. So progress is, I want progress on all of those things in my first term, but you know, obviously real change takes time to deliver, but I'm on with it.
And how much of that can you deliver yourself, and how much of, you know, big picture stuff can you deliver yourself, and how much has to be through working with members of this panel and beyond?
Well, I think that's the opportunity that devolution brings to change the way politics works. So move away from the old idea that we determine everything. You sit in a room, you know, Kieran and I, and we just produce a plan and say, right, that's it, everyone go and do it. That's the old way of thinking and working. You know, the way things are now, with the challenge on public spending, but the challenge that everyone faces in terms of resources and investment, means we all should work and think differently. And the way I'm approaching things is open up to people, help us write the plan for where we want to go as a city region. So I held a digital summit earlier in the summer, and I brought people together working in the digital and tech sector and said, help us write the plan for skills, infrastructure, business development. And I did that because the more that people buy into the and have an involvement in the plan, I think the more people will own it and help drive its implementation. I'm doing the same with homelessness. I'm saying to all the groups working with rough sleepers and homeless people, help us write the plan. Because actually, if they own the plan as well, I think, again, it will have a better chance of being delivered. And for me, devolution offers the chance not just to bring decisions closer to people, but to open them up and let people have a much greater level of involvement in how those policies are devised and then hopefully implemented.
Okay, thank you. I've got a question for the rest of the panel on the back of that. But firstly, we've also got a poll about what you think the mayor's priorities should be. So perhaps we could put that up and you can engage with that in Slido, and then we'll have a look at the responses in a moment. But from the rest, for the rest of the panel, I'd like to know, if you were mayor for a day, what would your priority be? Sheila, I'll start with you.
Thank you. I was just thinking that through, actually, because I think, personally, I think that there needs to be some sort of revolution in education, but those powers are not actually devolved down to the regional level. So if the powers were available, I really think education needs a good going at. And also just basic service stuff around care for the elderly. So I think in terms of all of our own personal lives, I think those two areas of life at the GM level is actually something we may want to address and look at differently and make a priority.
Okay, thank you. This is going to get harder as I go along the line, isn't it? Kieran.
People in this room might remember the Manchester Independent Economic Review, and it looks about Manchester as a conurbation and how Manchester can grow. And it said school readiness was one of the biggest weaknesses that we have. And I know that's one of Andy's pledges, but for me, it would also be a pledge, because if you just look at life chances, you look at wealth accumulation, you look at all the boxes that we tick for people, it starts by being school ready. And it's also around health. So for me, that is a priority, will continue to be a priority, because that's holding Manchester back, it's holding the growth of Manchester back. So in my experience, we have the ability, you know, to make sure that every young person has a life chance. And that's why it'd be a priority for me.
Okay, thank you. Tom.
I think all of those are very laudable, and I concur with most of them, to be honest. But it is about creating those chances for the younger people. It's about education. It's about creating environments that people want to be in. It's about transport. It's about lots of different things. So there isn't just one solution, I think, but many. It's a challenge, I know, for Andy to cover those, but he's tackling it in a very positive way. So we'll see where it goes.
Okay, and Darren, let's assume that health and education are being dealt with.
Yeah. And infrastructure as well, so that'll be. I think Manchester's a world city, and it needs to project the image of being a world city, and I think Andy's pledge on homelessness is really important for us to demonstrate that we fit in those categories of world cities. It's a big problem. Everybody sees that it's an increasing problem, and I think as an image for bringing inward investment in from outside of the country, it's really important to portray that image well.
Okay, Jeremy?
And I suppose taking up that theme, I think we could do something dramatic and improve the entrance of a world city. When you come out of Piccadilly train station and the pedestrian route, whichever route you take, is not an attractive route when you get from Piccadilly train station to Piccadilly Gardens, down Piccadilly Approach, into Market Street. It's not the welcome and the gateway scenery which I think we would like the world to see when they first step into Manchester. And once you get out of that, there are many, many more pleasant places to see.
OK, I'll put some of those to Andy in a second, but can we see the results of the poll? What does the audience think should be the priority? So it's housing.
Yeah.
That doesn't surprise you, presumably.
No, not at all. I mean, I agree with all of the things that have also been said, and I think, as Tom was saying, you know, you've already got to do more than one thing at once. But housing, absolutely. The clearest illustration of a housing market that's not working is the homelessness and the rough sleeping that we see. But it's a much deeper and broader problem than that. It's young people who can't get onto the housing ladder. It's obviously people in private rented accommodation that's not of a decent or a safe standard. It's a lack of appropriate housing for older people that supports their care in the home. Housing is a much broader issue than sometimes the narrowness of the housing debate allows. It's often X many thousand, and it's all a very figures-based debate rather than a quality-based debate. You know, what are we building for whom, and where are we building it, and how together are we going to solve this housing crisis? So, yeah, it doesn't surprise me that people see housing as the very top of the tree. We have a housing crisis, as elsewhere does in Greater Manchester. I would argue that Westminster has given this crisis to us, and we should use devolution to fix it. Yeah.
Okay, and how much of that is in your gift, and how much of the change will come about through influence, whether it's upwards into Westminster or sideways into some of the borough councils and other councils?
Well, I want to agree a partnership with all of our 10 local authorities so that I can add value to what they want to do, you know, because I do get powers as mayor, powers to set up mayoral development zones through a mayoral development corporation, and then compulsory purchase powers should they be needed to open up sites for development and speed up the delivery of housing projects. So, you know, there are things that I can add. I think the issue is Greater Manchester agreeing where it wants to go with housing, identifying the sites, and you know, we're doing that at the moment through the rewrite of the spatial framework. I do want to have a new focus on our town centres. You know, I want to see more housing in the town centres that circle Greater Manchester, particularly to the north, but right the way around, because I think there's great potential there to revitalise those places and build higher density housing in them. So we need to create our vision, but absolutely, once the mayor and hopefully the 10 leaders has got a shared vision, which we're working on and we will get, then it's all about using the powers to deliver it. You know, there is a Greater Manchester Housing Fund, the Chancellor's promised us borrowing powers, Kieran chairs the Greater Manchester Pension Fund. You know, there are levers at our disposal, and I think it's about you know, perhaps getting better at coordinating them all behind those transformational housing schemes that we need to see.
Okay, and Kieran, how can your pension fund help?
We've already started the process in Greater Manchester. We have an organisation called Matrix Homes. If anyone remembers that wonderful programme, Shameless, about ordinary folk in Manchester. And if you remember that shopping area, you could buy literally anything you want. In fact, I don't think you could buy groceries there, but you could buy everything else. That site was used for the film production company because it had not been developed. Even through all the better years, it hadn't been developed. Greater Manchester Pension Fund came along in partnership with Manchester City Council. That is now a new housing scheme. There were 72 houses there of mixed tenure, some for owner occupation, some for commercial rents. It's about bringing new products onto the market to make sure that we fill that need that we have. And there's so much more that we can do. I'm already setting a target for our pension fund. Our pension fund world is changing. The government's challenged us to increase our scale. We're already, as you say, we're actually near 21 billion now. We've had quite a good quarter. And we're doing a lot around housing. We're working now with Merseyside and West Yorkshire. And we're going to send back to government the proposal that working with the industry, not on our own, as has been said, we're going to try and develop 10,000 units working with people, so whether it's through financial instruments, whether it's direct build, whether it's actually acquisition of opportunities. So that's what we're looking at. That's the start of our journey, so there's more that we need to do. But the Greater Manchester Pension Fund and other pension funds are really open to help us deliver the housing that we so desperately need in this country.
Thank you. And Sheila, the coordinated vision that Andy talked of a moment ago, is that going to be the reality?
I think it already is the reality. We're all sharing these, I think they're fairly universal problems across a lot of cities, not just in this country, actually. I was recently fortunate enough to be in the States. And again, the direction of travel for a lot of those American cities is truly appalling in terms of the number of homeless people that you see. In spite of the fact that you might have, for instance, a healthy tech sector. I think how cities work and how we solve these problems together is the continuing challenge for anyone involved in this industry. I've worked in public and private sector, recently moved back into Salford City Council. Local authorities have changed hugely since I was last in the public sector in terms of resources available to them, in terms of funding, in terms of just staff resources. And I think it's incumbent on everybody working with us in this sector to realise that there just isn't the resource, there aren't the people inside councils that there used to be, and we must form these partnerships together to solve these problems, because they're not easy problems to address. If they were easy, we would have addressed them, wouldn't we? But coming up with those solutions at the very local level in Greater Manchester, I can't believe it's not beyond our wit together to come up with something, and why not fairly quickly?
Okay, thank you. Andy?
Well, I just wanted to pick up on all the things that are being said, because I completely agree with what Sheila just said. And the thing I would say is, housing's top of the list, but let's also think about housing in terms of how it might contribute to the other things that we want to do, so we get a coherent vision for Greater Manchester, I think, as Tom was saying. So I have an ambition around retaining more graduates in Greater Manchester, so people who study here, staying here. I have ambitions around the way we care for older people and having a care system that is much more around supporting people in their own home. And there are companies here tonight, like Evermore, I think we're represented in the room there. Hi, Sarah. Who have got innovative ideas about how you build homes as places where care might be provided, where people can stay, rather than just being hospitalised through a poor care system. So the thing I would say is, and also I mentioned a third there, revitalising town centres. So for me, it's how can housing policy really knit together to those other agendas around retaining graduates, helping young people, improving town centres, looking after old people. Housing policy needs to leave its silo and really kind of then come forward with the bigger picture answers on all of those other fronts. And then we'll really be getting somewhere if we can really knit it together with those wider policy objectives.
Thank you. I smiled because I saw Jeremy's expression out of the corner of my eye. Housing needs to come out of its silo.
Yeah, okay. Andy, it's not just a housing crisis. It's actually an immediate and pressing issue. It's not just a topic on the paper. This, I can't disagree with you about wanting to link housing as a integrated solution. I get that. But you're talking about people who cannot afford their own homes. We're talking about a significant decline in the ability to own homes. We're talking about 30-year-old, the young people of this country and this city cannot afford to buy a house. And they are living with their parents, they're living in substandard accommodation. There is a pressing and absolute need for housing to be addressed as an issue now. If you want to have a solution that looks at a wider gamut of other roles, that's great and laudable, but not at the expense of treating the housing crisis that we face.
Well, I understand that point, but it wasn't what I was saying, actually. What I was indicating was I am ready to intervene now, using the powers that I have as mayor around mayoral development, compulsory purchase, to clear those sites, because actually those sites, in my view, are more likely to deliver the higher density housing that will be more affordable to young people. I think we've had for too long too much of a developer-led approach where the developers say which sites they want to go to, and I don't think they do produce the homes that younger people can afford. So I think we do need to refocus, and refocus quite quickly, and that's what I've said with the rewrite of the spatial framework. Let's intervene in a different way here, kind of pick the sites and be more clear about what kind of housing we want to see, and be clear about levels of affordability and homes for social rent. I think you're right, we do need to do those things, but I am on with those things.
Tom, has there been too much of a developer-led approach?
No, I think the local authorities and the private sector need to work together. I think that's absolutely imperative. If you look at the sort of housing benefit bill, it's £27 billion a year or something. 30% of that goes to the private sector. That's a travesty, really, and we just need to grasp the nettle and make sure that we deliver the social housing that these cities require. And I think the local authorities and the councils can't do it on their own. I think it should be working with the private sector. We can provide those skills, we can provide that input, and we can look at the sites. I agree with Andy. I think that urbanisation is absolutely imperative. And I disagree slightly. I think the younger people, I don't think necessarily they all want to own their own home. I think they like the flexibility. They want to maybe look at where they are staying. They want to have that sort of flexibility to move around in the first few years, postgraduate, whatever. And then maybe buy a home further down the line. I think if you look at the sort of the world, in terms of ownership, we are still very high in terms of the rest of the world. So a lot of people rent accommodation. I don't think that's a bad thing. It shouldn't be seen as a bad thing, as long as it's affordable and as long as it's quality accommodation. So it's not just about owning, it's providing the right accommodation. It can be rented and still be positive.
Okay, thank you. And Darren, do you have a list of sites in a drawer which can be unlocked where delivery can take place quickly? Do your clients talk about that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think generally around the Manchester Centre area, you're looking at the millennials and they want to be closely connected to the city centre. So there are still sites in the Northern Quarter. There are areas heading out sort of Upper Brook Street and around the universities where the retention aim of students to stay within the city centre provides them with access into the city centre, but also gives them a new opportunity. If you look at Circle Square and those kind of developments which are happening, it connects them to the city. It's close to a cultural vibrant area, so there are those sites which are either in development or are in the process of acquisition, which with our clients that we're dealing with, we've dealt with one at M1 Central, which is in the Northern Quarter, and that's producing that type of accommodation, particularly with the younger generation that they want to aim for. But I think generally there needs to be a balanced approach in terms of the mix as well, because those young people do aspire to have a house with a garden eventually, and so we need to look at it on balance and not just need to wholly concentrate just on city centre development.
Okay, Tom, did you want to come in there?
No, I was just going to say that looking at the sort of social housing need and everything else, we've set up a new communities partnership, which is a joint venture with the HCA and also Cheney Social Property Fund. So that's specifically targeting producing around 10,000 socially affordable housings. And that's a key thing, and we want to do that with local authorities.
Just if I could add just a quick point, because I don't want anyone to get the wrong impression. I agree with Tom's point about partnership. I think it does need to be partnership. But if I could just come back and say, not just about the city centre. You know, I think we need to see the same ambition applied to those other outlying towns around Greater Manchester that actually probably will produce the homes that are more affordable to young people. So it's about kind of taking the partnership and taking the ambition that we've had in the city centre to develop modern ways of living and city centre living and take them to, we've seen it in Bury, but let's take it further afield, to Oldham, to Rochdale, to Bolton, Lee. Let's see that idea spread, really, but let's do it in partnership, where if I can intervene to make sites viable that might be not viable if you were doing it alone, that's the kind of approach that I think we need to get better at.
But that's also got to connect with the employment. And if you're looking at Manchester as a hub for employment, particularly if you're working in professional services or if you're working in media, then you've got to be connected to it as well. So there's an infrastructure issue as well, isn't it? If you look at Bolton, for example, we're working with a developer at the moment on part of the new scheme. which is in terms of residential, but there needs to be the connect to get from Bolton to other parts of Greater Manchester, and at the moment it's struggling. You know, you have to just look at the way it doesn't connect with itself. They either have to be close to the big core city centre, or they have to have sufficient infrastructure to be able to get them elsewhere, and I think that still needs improvement.
Okay, let's take a particular aspect of infrastructure. Catherine Harrison. Another microphone's coming. Don't shout yet. We'll go for shouting if this one doesn't work.
Hi. My question to the panel is, when do they expect the government to make Northern Powerhouse Rail a reality? And twofold, why isn't it a priority when London has Crossrail too?
I won't start with Andy this time. Sheila, you're gesturing.
I really haven't got an answer to it from my perspective. I mean, clearly I've been involved in a lot of the plan making and strategies. Some years ago I did some work in Liverpool actually about HS2 into Liverpool, and I think all of the strategizing and planning and case making, even though I've been in this industry for decades, it still frustrates me how long these processes take, because actually there's something else going on here, isn't there? We've got the cases, we've got the plans, we've got the routes. We need the actual investment, and we need that support from central government still. So I think it may be for others to get into a bit more detail about that.
Jeremy, why don't you think the commitment's been given? Is the case not strong enough? Is it not made well enough? Is it a finite pot? All of those things.
It's got to be a finance-related issue. There's only a certain amount of money available. There are competing projects and so on. I mean, one of the unintended consequences of having Andy Burnham as Manchester's mayor is the possibility of developing across the principal cities an extension of the Manchester All Party parliamentary grouping, which sat, I think, for the first time, Andy, was it, a couple of weeks ago. And I think if all the members of parliament for the constituencies relevant to the cities formed a caucus in Westminster, I'm sure that caucus could actually carry significant influence. I mean, if the DUP can get influence, I'm sure the caucus of the Northern MPs relevant to this debate can carry influence.
Okay, there's a subsidiary question here. With HS2 still years away and HS3 not yet given the green light, how will the decision to scrap rail line electrification impact development, Kieran? Is that a further blow?
I just think it's a disgrace. I think it shows exactly how out of balance our country is, how south, southern-centric, how London-centric we are. Literally, if you go out this room and just turn left, is where the actual devolution deal was signed. I'm one of the people that signed that deal. Why did we sign that deal? We signed that deal to finally shake off and break off the yoke that is dragging us as a conurbation, as an area, as a northwest and a northern economy down. So, yes, Crossrail too. Why would it get advantage? We're looking at electrification. They can't even support the electrification of two of the major northern cities. Now, Andy's been doing some great work around that, and I know there was a summit not so long ago in Leeds. And I think the government just doesn't understand the anger that there is in the north, and this is cross-party anger. You know, we heard before there isn't enough money going round. Well, we are still one of the most wealthy countries in the world. There is the money around. Part of the reason I'm here is to say there are pots. We need to be innovative about how we actually invest. But it's always amazing me how quickly the government can find money for a scheme in the south like Crossrail too, and yet it's prepared to let again the north drift. And if you don't feel that momentum, you know, there is a change taking place. And we want more powers, we want more resources, but we also want the ability to use those powers and resources to create our own independence as we move forward. Independence from having to have the cap out all the time to London. Manchester is the second city of the country. I quoted the Manchester Economic Review earlier. It showed that there were only two real economic spikes in this country, and Manchester is one of them. We need to free ourselves from being held back. And that's what devolution is doing, and we are at the start of that journey.
And is it something that your pension fund could support?
We have been supporting it. If you just again look around the corner, 1 St Peter's Square, it's the most prominent, I think, one building of the year only 18 months ago. That was our investment. We made that investment when people were moving out of the city centre, when people were moving out of the city, when there weren't any cranes around. That's the sort of thing that pension funds can do. The government has set us a challenge. We now work very closely with Merseyside and with West Yorkshire, and we are overseeing £45 billion worth of assets under management. We're looking at bringing together an impact portfolio of about 5%. And we're looking at significant monies. Now, clearly, we're not going to spend that all in one area, but we are looking about how we can use resources that we have to deliver. That money has come from workers in Manchester, workers in the Northwest. Isn't it about time that we started to invest in their communities, invest in their futures as well? And that's the sort of thing that we're doing in local government pensions. The London economy is overheated. We're already seeing, by the way, house prices for the first time in many years falling, and Manchester can fill that gap, and we can actually, we've got the ability and we've got the aspiration to do that.
Okay, Andy, is your optimism growing or pessimism growing around this?
I think directly to answer the question is when will we find out, or you know, when will we know that we're going to get the investment? Well, certainly not tomorrow, I'm afraid, because I've seen Chris Grayling's press release for his visit tomorrow. I can give you all a sneak preview of it. And it says in it, in black and white, that he's going to give us £5 million for digital improvements between Manchester and York, whatever they are, but he's now looking at electrification between Manchester and Leeds, which I'm afraid is a downgrading of the promise. Now, I've not come into this job to carry on point scoring. I'm not interested in that anymore. If the government does the right thing, I will say so. But if they do the wrong thing on behalf of you all and behalf of the public, I will also say so. And I'm afraid it's not good enough for them to be, as Kieran says, backsliding and backtracking on commitments that were already given, that in my view are essential investment to build a northern powerhouse. You have to link these great cities properly if you are to realise their potential. To answer the question that was posed about why we don't get the investment and competing resources, I'll tell you why we don't get it, why the North has historically lost out. I was Chief Secretary to the Treasury, and I'll own up at this point, I was the person who funded Crossrail 1. That was something I did in the 2007 spending review. Don't hold it, I can see you all there. I can hear the hissing about to start. But why did it get through? It got through because it can meet something called the BCR, which is what the Department for Transport and the Treasury use when they assess transport schemes. And what that is principally an economic test. Not a social value test, an economic value test. And it grades subjects on the extent to which they can add GVA to the country and the economy. So obviously schemes in London always will score higher, a higher BCR, than schemes in the north of England. However, my argument to that is back to the government, but actually when you were building the tube system, you weren't applying that BCR then. And if you look back, even in quite recent times, the Jubilee line didn't pass its BCR, but it was just decided that they needed it, so they built it. So we're just saying, give us the same so that we can build our economy, and then we won't come knocking on your door in 10 or 20 years. We'll try and do it with Kieran's help from the pension fund, and we'll try and be more self-sufficient, but we can't do it from a standing start. We need that basic infrastructure to get us going. And the minute they commit to a proper Crossrail for the North, the development opportunities would open up for us all, wouldn't they? And those partnerships that Tom was talking about at Piccadilly or at the airport, you know, the potential of that, of an HS2 system linked to a northern Crossrail would be enormous. And we've got to make that argument together, not politicians on our own, but with you, all of us, because in the end, it's about the north of England. And then this just brings me to the last point around parliamentary influence. I think that point is absolutely the right point. As somebody who was a Northern MP for 16 years, I don't think Northern MPs have punched their weight collectively enough for the North. So it's why I was in Leeds yesterday with the leader of Leeds Council, Newcastle, the West Yorkshire Combined Authority, to continue this discussion about, it's been called a Council of the North, but actually we're not sure that will be the name, but the idea is a representative body for Northern opinion on issues like transport and Brexit.
that might come together a couple of times a year and speak for the North as one on these critical issues. And then, having done that, ask our Northern MPs, all of them, to go to Parliament and work to bring about those conclusions. Because actually, to get directly to the point, which was about Crossrail for the North or Crossrail 2 in London, the government indicated its prioritisation in the summer, and it basically indicated that Crossrail 2 would be going ahead before our investment. My argument at the time was, hang on a second, in the new parliamentary arithmetic, take that judgment call to Parliament, and I think they'll come up with a different answer than giving it to London. I think they would back the north of England. I think there would be a will to from people in Wales and Scotland, Northern Ireland, to say, well, it actually is the north of England's turn. So we do have to get cleverer, work constructively with the government. However, be prepared to bare our teeth in Parliament if they're not listening. And that's the way London has lobbied over many, many years, the way they work. You know, they lobby ministers on every level, an organisation called London First. And we've got to get in that game as a North of England. Politicians, business leaders, civic leaders, cross-party, do it together and do it loudly and clearly and demand what we should have, which is proper investment in our infrastructure so that we can build a northern powerhouse economy.
And do Tom, Darren, Jeremy and their peers do enough to support the case? Should they be trying to price that opportunity cost of this infrastructure investment not having?
I think they do. I never feel that business doesn't... It does come forward and call for these things. And again, I think this is an opportunity of devolution. You know, when we have a Westminster system, it is about the point scoring and the political agendas. And I think business sometimes feels it's difficult to engage in that world. But actually, as we come out with devolution, I'm not interested in that. That's not my purpose in doing this job. It is about this place, Greater Manchester, the Northwest, the North. That's what I'm interested in. And I think when you make it about place rather than party as your main thing, I think you create an environment where it's even easier for business then to engage, because then there isn't a kind of set of different and unknown agendas. And I think devolution presents that opportunity. And I really don't want it to become a new form of Westminster politics run out of Manchester. And we've really got to change things, because it's only by changing things will that voice get heard and those old Treasury ways in London be finally and successfully challenged.
Okay, I think this is more of a comment than a question. Should we have a council for the North and who should lead it? A king in the North. But we won't deal with that. But I'll pick you up on something. Before we move on, I just want to pick you up on something you said there, Andy. You said that you're not interested in point scoring anymore. Westminster, to an outsider, feels like it's all about point scoring. Did you used to enjoy it?
Yeah, I'll be at times. You know, it's the sport of the place, isn't it? Because those two benches, the green benches, the place is physically built to encourage point scoring. Because you sit there all day, not looking at your friends and being nice to them, you sit there looking at the Tories and you're like, you know, that's what it's designed to do. It's almost designed to provoke kind of bitterness and acrimony. And I think that's part of its problem. It's one of its problems.
I was going to say, having stepped away, does that feel like it's not compatible with good decisions?
I feel liberated from that. I learned through my time in Parliament that actually if you put that stuff aside and you actively appeal to the other side on issues that matter, I did it on Hillsborough and worked with Theresa May on Hillsborough, you actually, when you see what can be done when you do that, you actually do reassess. You know, so as a younger MP, I probably enjoyed it too much. But as I got longer in the tooth in Parliament, I kind of realised that the public just wasn't interested and actually they wanted change on things that mattered to them. And so I really leave Westminster with that in my mind. I mean, the other big failing, of course, is that it's institutionally London-centric. So the House of Lords, I would say 95% of them, I'm just guessing, but I think it's probably about that, their main address would be within London. The House of Commons would be more mixed, but you still a lot of MPs' main abode is London. The government civil service, practically all of them live within the M25. These are the people that are making our decisions. You know, that is their sphere of reference, the London view of life. So no wonder we have a political system that leaves half the country feeling alienated and kind of kicking back at the European referendum. I mean, you know, that's the time that we're in now, and we need to use devolution to fix it.
Okay, thank you. We're up against the clock, and I would like to cover a couple of other topics quickly. Peter Whittingham. And then I'll come to Coral Granger. If you could raise your hand, we'll get the other microphone to you.
Thank you. During the election, Andy Burnham mentioned a radical rewrite of the GMSF with a focus on social housing, brownfield land and town centres. But given the recognised housing need in Greater Manchester, is a radical rewrite actually achievable?
Thank you. Darren, do you want to see a radical rewrite?
I think, as we said before, I think there needs to be a consideration of the right development in the right places, but it does require, particularly on the housing front, as we said before, looking at a balance in that regard. It needs to address the affordability of housing, certainly. But I think that to concentrate purely on brownfield development is not the whole picture. I think that there does need a balance in that area.
Okay, and Tom, radical rewrite, is that necessary?
I think it's sensible to have a look at it again, and there's no harm.
Sensing no's. I'm sensing no to the question. Is a radical rewrite the right thing to do?
I think there's no harm in having a relook at it. It's a pressing problem. Why just sit with the status quo? Let's look at the issues. Let's have a relook at it, and we can implement a new strategy, hopefully.
Jeremy, yes or no?
I don't think a radical rewrite is necessary, no, in blunt terms. I can understand why the Mayor's office wouldn't have a change of emphasis because there are different policies and considerations. I fully understand that. I think the imperative is to get something out. It's imperative that we actually move forward on housing. My preference will be to accept that it's a document such as the GMSF is a very, very complicated document to write. We haven't had one before. And so I think a series of working papers that would explain the direction of travel would actually be very helpful so that the communities who are going to be responsible for engaging and delivering, both the business development communities and those people who benefit from development, can actually understand and get to grips with the issues. I think just saying it's going to happen is unhelpful.
Okay, thanks. Sheila, radical, modest or not at all?
I think radical is good. I think quickly is good as well. I think there's a huge amount of work that has gone into it already. There's colleagues of mine in Salford and in other authorities around GM been working on it for some time. I think if that relook at it can be fairly quick and efficient, then I think that would help all of us to get the clarity around what direction we're travelling in. And it was an enormously ambitious project to begin with. And again, I think we should just remember that this is part of Greater Manchester's ambition. A spatial framework that's set in statutory planning across that geography is unique, is it not? So I think we're kind of almost there. And if we need to revisit some of the priorities, then let's do it as quickly as possible.
Thank you. And Kieran, briefly.
Yeah, briefly, Manchester is based on radicalism, so a radical rewrite is not an issue. But we need to remember that the Greater Manchester Spatial Framework sits on top of the locality plans, sits on top of the next 10 to 15 years' worth of land availability. So it's got to be put the two together. So we do have time to get this right. We've got to get this right because it's for the next 25 to 30 years. So if the pause and a refresh look, and then we come back with a plan that the public accepts is something that will deliver housing need for today and the future, then absolutely, because there's a lot going on out there as it is. There's a land available for us to continue to develop for the next 5 to 10 years, so we've got the chance to have that radical rewrite.
Okay, thank you. Someone has rightly pointed out that we shouldn't just be thinking about King of the North, of course, Queen of the North, potentially, but I'm going to park that as a question again. So, Andy, still radical. I'm getting a sense of caution and just, you know, have a good look, but perhaps rein back from that.
There will be a rewrite. Let me be absolutely clear about that. You know, you'll probably have to judge whether you think it's radical or not, but that is my intention. I mean, let me describe why I said that. The original draft, which I don't, you know, for every reason Kieran and Sheila gave, this is complex and difficult. It's not easy, and it needs to be an iterative process. But when I looked at that draft, I didn't think it was a vision for Greater Manchester that was good enough. I felt it would lead to decaying town centres surrounded by urban sprawl and ever-congested roads. They're already congested. I didn't think it had all been thought through enough. And therefore, I couldn't put my, you know, kind of put my name to it, and I wanted it to change. So that's what we're on with now. And I do want to, the radical bit comes in saying, I think the first plan reflected what I said before about a developer-led approach. And I'm not criticising any developer in the room, it's the system we've been in. But the idea that we ask people to call for sites and then everyone puts up their wish list of sites, and I don't think that necessarily, to pick up a phrase used before, builds the right home in the right places. I would rather look at, as I say, town centres integrated with transport interchanges, linked to cycling, new cycling infrastructure, maybe linked to digital and startup space. That, for me, is about a more coherent plan that builds the right kind of homes that people need, to go back to our earlier discussion, but also doesn't mean that we're just becoming ever more car dependent and completely congested. So that's the change. You know, let's start there and see if we can, with the partnership Tom spoke of, develop different ways of thinking. And the link with transport interchanges is absolutely critical. We currently have a bid in with the government for the devolution of train stations in GM. Now, they've turned down our initial bid for all stations to be devolved, which I find quite outrageous, actually, because 30 or so of our stations are not even wheelchair accessible. So how can the current incumbents who are running them claim that they're doing a good job? They're not. I think we could do it. Kieran and I and the other leaders had the linkages to local communities. We could do a better job of running those stations. But we've now got a kind of smaller list of stations in. And I think if they give us the go-ahead on that, we can immediately link it to new homes possibilities. And I think that then becomes more coherent, more integrated, you know, a better plan. And just the last point I would make, you know, we do have to take the public with us. I was saying earlier, wasn't I, about if we're all involved in plans and we all listen, and if then what comes out of it is something that everyone can say, well, okay, at least I can see where that's come from. This plan will stand the test of time then, won't it? It'll be a plan we can all get behind, that I can go around the world and sell. But if it's done in the teeth of opposition, then I just don't think it's going to, you know, going to do the job that we all want it to do. I want an ambitious, inspiring, coherent plan for the future of Greater Manchester. And I think if we can, between us, get there by June next year, because I absolutely commit to you to this tonight, it will be published, the next version, in June. We will stick to that timetable. If we can get it in the right place, and there will still be difficult decisions, by the way, I'm not saying there won't be, there will still be difficult decisions, but if we can get consensus behind it, the power of that document will be immense for Greater Manchester.
And you're right to say the people here and outside of this building should be the judge of whether it's radical or not. But where you're sat today, do you feel that what you want to push through is something that's radical by your own definition?
Yes, because it reflects a mindset change from where we were, which I think is a kind of just allowing development to yay or nay it and sit back. And I'm saying we need a more interventionist approach here, where we say, well, where are the places that we can sustain higher density housing linked to transport, and then how do I intervene? You know, it needs to be a plan that's developed on the basis that the mayor has powers to facilitate and develop. And if we do it more in that partnership spirit, I think we'll get to better answers than the ones we came to in the first draft.
Okay, thank you. I know we're up against the clock. I'll take a question from Coral Granger and then one last question.
Hi, thank you. Maybe broader than housing and thinking about those economic schemes, what can we do to really maximise the development and investment opportunities in those northern and eastern boroughs, the Wiggins, the Tamesides and the Rochdales?
That overlaps with a question from Henry Brooks that was in Slido. How do we ensure that these are great places? Kieran?
It's about inclusive growth. If there's one weakness of Greater Manchester over 20 years, and it's been a really, really great success story, is we have lost some of the ability to invest in some of those towns and those areas. We've sometimes fallen into the treasury trap that Andy describes and looked about where we got a bigger return. And so one of the key focuses that we have now as leaders on the combined authority is around making sure that inclusive growth is written into everything that we do. So when we make a decision on investment, we make a decision on a bid for grant, whatever we're doing, we need to make sure that it isn't just about the easy hits, it's about making sure that those communities furthest away from the centre, whether it's furthest away from the Manchester centre or sometimes furthest away from their own town centre, places like Hattersley, which is literally right on the edge of the conurbation. There's a huge amount of work that we're doing as a council there, regenerating that area. It's making sure that all of our communities grow at the same time and at the same speed. And that's not going to be easy, and that's a journey. We've got to turn that tanker around, but we've got to make sure that for the decisions we make over the next 5, 10, 15 years has to include the outlying districts of Greater Manchester as well as the internal districts. One reason why the Housing Investment Fund that Andy talks about, why we initially with the government money and the rules, again, rules that the government gave us, we had to make a quick decision. We invested in some of the apartment-led developments in the centre of Manchester and some in Salford, but we're now getting the return of that money, and Andy's made it quite clear, working with the leaders, that money's now going to find its way out to the districts, so making sure that our decisions aren't just Manchester-centric.
And Jeremy, are these viable places for serious private sector investment?
They can be. It's a matter of the overall sense of return. I think the ambition is right. You can't knock the idea that the outlying towns and other centres should receive some form of inward investment. I don't think that Manchester, over its recent history, has paid sufficient regard to those other further afield towns for all the reasons outlined just now. So I share the ambition. The trouble is the approach that's been adopted has been effectively a trickle-down approach. So get everything right in the city centre and let the benefits of the wealth of the city centre start to be felt further and further afield. The trouble with the trickle-down approach, although it works, it can be too small of a trickle. And I think that's probably the problem that's being picked up on. So I think at this stage it's probably looking at how can the councils invest in urban realm, how can they create the environment for inward investment. That's where my commentary on the plan comes from. If you can just get the direction of travel out so you can create a degree of certainty, people will buy into it. And I think you know, the trickle-down theory should still remain, but it should be not such a small trickle.
And Andy, very briefly, is that what a radical approach might prioritise?
Yes, and I think to answer the question directly, if I may, because there is a difficult bit here, because, you know, it's not all easy when I say I'm rewriting the spatial framework. There is difficult stuff in there. One of the difficult things might be to turn around the fortunes of some of these towns is to recognise that they'll never be the retail centres that they once were. So I look at Lee, my former constituency, and it has kind of retail space that we're kind of clinging on to, but it then gets filled with these low-grade uses that make the whole place look a bit depressed. And I think the difficult bit when it comes to town centre regeneration is to recognise that there's quite a lot of redundant retail space that possibly should be taken away. The retail core of those places should be shrunk back, hopefully to a more quality core, and then you free up much more residential space. And actually, I think town centre living is attractive, or could be, in the same way that city centre living is attractive. Not just for younger people, but for older people. Who wants to be in a care home in a field somewhere? Well, I don't think they do. You know, let's make it more attractive. You know, bring life back into these towns that have become, you know, a bit kind of, they've lost pride, haven't they? And I think you can bring it back. But I do think it is about fundamentally changing their purpose, which is away from these retail centres of the 50s and 60s, now much more to residential centres. And that does mean that the transport links then that support people living there, having a quality of life and possibly working in the city centre.
OK, thank you. Let's move on to that last question, which I'll bring in a couple of things. What does the future look like for Manchester and investment in it post-Brexit? Was one that came in on Slido. And also, what should Manchester's message be on the international stage in order to continue to attract inward investment? And I'll overlap it with one more question. You can answer whichever one you choose. But how do we avoid not becoming our worst enemy in this? I heard a great phrase this week where Boris Johnson was described as being inside the tent pissing in. And it looks like it sometimes feels like we're, you know, we are our own worst enemy here. So what should Manchester's message be? What does the future look like post-Brexit? And how do we make sure we succeed? Tom?
Are we talking post-Brexit as in 2019 post-Brexit or post-referendum?
Choose your time frame.
But I think, well, you know, since the referendum last year and the decision to come out of Europe, there hasn't been a lack of investment into Manchester. In anything, you see more international investment come in. Maybe that's because of the devaluation of the pound or whatever. So I think Manchester is recognised as a international city and people like to invest in Manchester. It's a recognised name. So I think you've got to work with that and play to that, and I think Manchester's doing that very well. So I think the future potentially for Manchester is very good. I'm not a pessimist, I'm an optimist, and I think Manchester's grown significantly over the last 25 years. I think it's done a really excellent job, and it's just about making sure you don't lose sight of that, working with the benefits that you've created, and you'll continue to get the investment that you want to get.
Thank you. Darren?
I think Manchester's demonstrated that it can get external investment from international. If you look at Airport City and the way that Amazon have come in and the logistics base there through to the city centre, I think they need to concentrate on selling itself as the world city and a great place to start businesses up outside of London, and I think that will follow.
Okay, Sheila.
I think we've all actually benefited from the Manchester brand. I mean, we don't have a problem with this. Over the years, Manchester has already positioned itself really well in the international markets. If we're talking about real estate and property and international finance, I think we've already got a really good brand. We need to keep building on that to bring in the investment. And at the same time, we have all of these local requirements, we have political priorities, we have community priorities about how that all gets played out. So at the end of the day, whilst we're talking about development, these are not just pure real estate issues. If it was as simple as that, I'd kind of say, well, the job is almost done in a sense. I think it might be a mistake to think about the urban core as either an easy fix or finished or that's done now. Salford is really interesting because it is partly urban core. It's part of that city centre expansion, and we want to see more of that. We have to be commercial, but we also, as an authority, stretch all the way over to Warrington through lots of different geographies, those small towns that need further investment. And we've got Media City in the middle of this as well, which is a unique story. So I think there's a huge amount that's been done. I don't think anybody knows the implications of Brexit, actually. But I would always want to be positive and just make progress in terms of those local decisions.
Okay, Jeremy, you've been on this panel before and you will have had a version of this question before. Is it any different now we're looking at a different future?
I think there's a fantastic feel about Manchester. I think the word brand, as Sheila's used, is absolutely right. The I Heart MCR, I Love Manchester, fantastic. I was on the tram a few weeks ago when there was three girls taking up three sets of double seats, all of them, and they were speaking very loudly, and one of them said, but I really love Manchester. She's very proud. And I think that's probably something to export, and I think that's what we've got to capitalise on in terms of where do we want to see Manchester in the future. Mottram Hall, just outside Presbury, if you look at its marketing literature, it doesn't say Presbury Cheshire, it says Mottram Hall Manchester. So, you know, the corporate world's bought into the Manchester brand. People in Manchester have the Manchester brand. And I think that's a great gift that the previous administrations of Manchester have been able to bring about and for, you know, given Andy a great platform to work with.
Thank you. And Kira, does your investment strategy change? You're looking at long horizons.
The investment strategy absolutely changes, but I mean, they say you should never use cliches or stereotypes, but I think a cliche should be we're open for business, yeah? And by the way, a stereotype is this view of the arrogant mank at times, yeah? And I think we need to hold on to that, and that's got us in a good place. And I think we should not be frightened of the future. The whole of Manchester was built on struggle, was built on finding hurdles, getting over those hurdles. And I think, you know, that's held Manchester in good stead. Andy talked before about the negativity of Westminster. Remember where you're at. You know, it's been because of political working together across party. When I first became leader, there were five non-Labour authorities and five Labour authorities, yet the success of Manchester continued. And sometimes it's easy to look down and be negative. I think we do need to remember, you know, it is about that Mancunian arrogance. We know we're better than the rest of the country, and we know that we can deliver better than the rest of the country.
And Andy, everyone has resisted the Boris prompt. You can have that one.
And I agree with Kieran as someone born in Liverpool, actually. That's a, I mean, as everyone said, the fundamentals are so strong. And you feel it. I felt it, you know, in terms of coming into the role, that the power of this place, you know. Tuesday the 23rd of May is obviously a day none of us will ever forget. I remember driving in here at 5 in the morning feeling sick to the pit of my stomach, but I felt the strength of this place immediately, just in the way people were, straight away in my own building, Churchgate, but then everywhere, you know, the way, the whole place, just kind of, you know, you feel it, the strength in the, of the partnerships that have been built, not just between the public bodies, but with the private sector, everything, you know, it's strong. So the fundamentals are incredible. We are the country's music capital, sporting capital, as I was reminded at Old Trafford on Sunday. I would say, you know, capital of media and creative, you know, but at looking to the future, I think I want to set, we do need to set the next layer of ambitions. I think we should, and I have said this, we should be the UK's leading digital and tech city region. Top five in Europe. You know, that should be a clear goal given the fundamentals that we've got. I launched this week an ambition around the greenest city region. You know, we've got to get ourselves into low carbon because that is about making our economy ready with the right capability for the future. But actually, just to finish on the point I think Sheila made earlier, the strength of this place ultimately, and Kieran's making this point, is in its people. That is our best strength. But at the moment, we're not training all of them enough to fulfil their potential. And I think we do need to do something radical in that space around technical education and giving all young people hope at 16 that there is something there for them. That's what the free bus pass is all about. And I want to link that to a single system for apprenticeships in Greater Manchester. It is about hope and opportunity, because if all of our people have hope, then we really are going somewhere. And the message I can say to those potential investors around the world is, we have got a skills pipeline here that will deliver for you. The talent is here and you will be able to access it. So I think it's all there. And actually the last thing is maybe to hark to that history that Kieran mentioned. This has traditionally been, right through its history, the home of radical forward thinking. Industrial innovation, entrepreneurial disruption, but also social innovation too. And, you know, suffragettes, the trade union movement, these things began here because this has been a place that has, you know, disrupted and innovated all through its history. But it's done both, hasn't it? It's done the kind of the commercial side of it, but also socially looked after people. And that's why homelessness is important when it comes to our image going forward. We need to be a place that doesn't leave anybody behind, you know, that is ambitious, does want to succeed and make money, but also wants to look after everybody and doesn't allow the kind of inequality that we're seeing creeping in around the world. So, yeah, you know, I don't for 1 minute regret leaving Westminster. I'm the luckiest person going with the opportunity that's before, not just me, but all of us. And the thing is, for 5 or 10 years here, nowhere else is going to have a devolution deal like ours. And I just would say to you all, let's not waste this moment. You know, this is a moment really to come together and put the foot on the pedal, because Greater Manchester won't get this moment again. And it will be what we all make of it together. But we've got everything going for us, and we've really just got to get out there and sell it.
Okay, we could go on. We can't, I'm afraid. Thank you to our sponsors, Savills, Gately, Kier, Greater Manchester Pension Fund, Apart Hotels, and the property networking group Young Entrepreneurs in Property, which is launched in Manchester now, and Ashley and Shiro are around, so grab them over drinks. Thank you for your questions, and please do thank our panel.